Okay, well, good morning to everybody, and if anybody is new to our program, welcome. Lots to talk about this morning. So very recently, I had a call from a new client who had been sued in a wage and hour case, and the client assumed that the liability would be covered under their employment practices liability insurance. And so what we quickly found was that there was an express exclusion in their policy, as it's pretty common for wage and hour claims. And I wanted to spend a couple minutes on this because it does have practical import for many of you who probably have existing employment practices liability insurance. And wage and hour cases can be serious and costly. Frankly, the Department of Labor recently reported that in the 2021 fiscal year alone, they assisted more than 190,000 workers and recovered more than $230 million in back wages and initiated nearly 25,000 compliance actions. So I wanted to spend a couple minutes to give you some practical advice on those of you who have responsibilities or recommendations to make regarding your EPLI policies, and I'm hoping that you all do have EPL policies. So in many of the employment practices liability policies, two things may occur with regard to wage and hour claims. One is that there's an express exclusion for wage and hour claims. The other is that if there's not an express exclusion, there's a provision that indicates that the only thing that the coverage will be applicable to is your defense cost, not your indemnity or liability if there's liability to be found. And so this can be a very costly thing, and those of you who have in your companies EPLI insurance, it would be a good time to go back, take a look at your policies, and see whether or not you have express exclusions for wage and hour claims, or if you don't have an express exclusion, whether it will only cover defense cost. And under either of those circumstances, I think it's a good time to have a conversation with your broker about when your policy comes due, to engage in sort of a twofold analysis. One is to see whether you can get a separate rider for wage and hour liability claims, not simply defense costs, but for indemnity or liability protection. And secondly, take a look at whether or not under these policy provisions, the carrier has what's called a duty of defense, meaning that it chooses your defense counsel as opposed to you choosing your own defense counsel, which is an important thing because oftentimes you're going to have a continuing relationship with your employment attorneys. And the time to make sure that you have the right to have a separately endorsed defense counsel is at the time when you purchase or renew your EPLI policy. So again, it would be a good time from a due diligence standpoint to really take a good look or have somebody take a good look at your EPLI coverage and specifically your wage and hour claim protection. Okay, I wanted to spend a couple minutes on some issues that are arising now as we at least see daylight coming out of the pandemic. And oftentimes I've been faced with questions regarding employees who assert that because of stress and anxiety and the fear of coming back into a physical workplace, that they have the right under the ADA to work entirely remotely. And so I wanted to address a few questions that come out of that particular situation as you may be involved in these kinds of questions. So one question, are employees protected under the ADA and state equal employment laws if they assert or experience stress and anxiety due to COVID-19? And the answer to that is that under the ADA, as you probably all know, the test for whether or not something can be classified as a covered disability is rather vague and pretty general. So we know that stress and anxiety from COVID-19 can certainly rise to the level of a disability under the ADA. However, you do have the right as the employer to obtain a medical certification from a healthcare provider, which would substantiate the legitimacy of the employee's stress and anxiety and the alleged need for an accommodation. And so that brings me to the second question, which is whether you can require an employee with even a medically certifiable stress and anxiety situation to return to the workplace. And the short answer to that is yes, you can, with the caveat of having the obligation to engage in an interactive dialogue with the employee to see whether or not it would be practical for that employee to work entirely at home or remotely or in a hybrid situation. So the mere fact that an employee has a certifiable disability related to stress or anxiety, which again in turn may be related to COVID, doesn't give that employee a free pass to work entirely remotely at home. Instead, you really need to engage in an interactive dialogue with that employee and to ascertain whether it would be practical for that employee to work entirely remotely at home, which it may be. On the other hand, it may not be if the employee is a manager and the manager needs to be on site or there are other duties and responsibilities that require that employee to be on site in order to carry out the full essential duties of the particular job description. The next question that comes up in this sort of, you know, context is, can you as the employer ask the employee about his or her stress, fear, and anxiety during the interactive process? And the answer to this is that if you've gotten a medical certification which confirms the employee's disability, you really shouldn't generally engage in further medical inquiries unless the certification is unclear. However, as the employer, you certainly can inquire about the medical or self-imposed restrictions due to the so-called employee's COVID-related stress and anxiety. So, for example, you can ask questions as follows in order to assess whether or not there's a legitimate need to work either partly or wholly remotely. So one question you can ask the employee is, does the employee leave their home at any time? And if so, how often? And if the employee wears a mask when they leave their home, you want to know that. Secondly, does the employee spend time with family and others not living in the household? Obviously, the extent to which that employee visits with other family members militates in favor of the employee's ability to work at your physical space as opposed to home. Third, does the employee go to public places? And if so, with what frequency, such as a grocery store, shopping area, restaurant, child school, or attending children's activities? Fourth, does the employee drive in a vehicle? And if so, how often? And does the employee drive with others? And last, has the employee traveled over the last year? And if so, how often, where, and when? All these questions can be legitimately asked in an interactive process to ascertain whether a so-called stress and anxiety related situation would in any way preclude that employee from working on your physical space. And they're certainly permissible under the ADA. And during that interactive process, there are certainly other things that you can inquire about. So you could ask and discuss with the employee any specific working conditions or job duties that trigger his or her concerns. This is all part of the interactive process. Secondly, whether there would be any specific accommodations that would permit the employee to work physically on your space, such as certain use of PPE, you know, mask or other kinds of PPE, whether you can socially distance that employee, whether you can restrict in-person meetings, or whether or not the employee can work in a private space. The bottom line on this is if you get these kinds of claims by employees, don't just assume that the employee is going to be able to work remotely either all the time or even partially. Engage in an aggressive and active interactive dialogue to ascertain whether practically you need to or can accommodate that particular employee, and it really is determined on a case-by-case basis. And while we're talking about case-by-case basis, I recently had a religious accommodation issue come up with a client. And sort of ironically, the Third Circuit covers Pennsylvania and New Jersey, recently dealt with a religious accommodation issue. So this was a case called Groff versus DeJoy, and the employee had informed the employer of his inability to work on Sundays because that was his Sabbath and he needed to observe it. The employer, when faced with this sort of conundrum, offered to engage in a shift swap with other employees if the other employees were willing to swap with this particular employee. As it turns out, they were not willing to swap, and the employee was disciplined and eventually resigned, claiming that he was compelled to resign because of the employer's failure to accommodate his religious practice. So the Third Circuit started off and said, look, the shift swap did not eliminate the conflict between his religious practice and work obligations, and therefore there at least ostensibly was a failure of a reasonable accommodation. However, they went on to say that the accommodation requested by the employee to be exempt by Sunday work would cause an undue hardship on the company. And so what the law, as you may know, is that A, you have a reasonable accommodation issue, but B, even if there's a reasonable accommodation, if that accommodation imposes a undue burden on the employer, and the undue burden is not a hard burden to meet under the religious accommodation test, unlike a disability test. And what the Third Circuit said was that there would be a burden here in that there could affect the morale of the employee, the employer's operations, or productivity, and that therefore they found for the employer in this case. What this all really militates in favor of is that if and when you get faced with a religious accommodation issue, there really is a need, again, like a disability situation, to engage in an interactive dialogue in which you explore whether or not there are ways to accommodate the particular employee. So, for instance, you could have a change of schedule, you could grant a paid or unpaid leave, or even a transfer. The point is, you can't just speculate that it would cause an issue for the company. You really need to be able to say objectively that the accommodation requested by the employee would pose an undue burden on the employer. And by the way, it's not a high burden to meet, unlike in a disability situation. But there is a burden to meet, and you really need to decide these cases on a case-by-case basis and look at the individual facts and circumstances which underlay the particular request for a religious accommodation. Another thing that has come to the forefront lately on a couple of occasions, at least with my clients, is the distinction between workers' compensation and how that may impact a claim for family and medical leave. So generally, the difference, by the way, between workers' compensation and family medical leave, as you may or may not know, workers' compensation is essentially an income replacement and medical cost benefit for employees. So employees who have an accidental injury or an illness arising out of and in the course of their employment are entitled to workers' compensation benefits, which will provide a variety of benefits. And if the employee is totally disabled for a period of time, temporarily totally disabled, workers' compensation will indeed replace the income to a certain extent lost and pay for medical expenses. Unlike family and medical leave, workers' compensation is not a job-protecting statute. The only exception to that is in those states, including Maryland, where the employer, when initially faced with a workers' compensation claim, terminates the employee solely for filing that workers' compensation claim. But importantly and distinctively, a workers' compensation claim does not give rise, unlike a family and medical leave situation, to job protection. So if you have somebody who's out on workers' compensation, for instance, for 8 months or 10 months, which is the case sometimes with clients of mine, they're under the assumption that workers' compensation is job protection. It is not. It is not like family and medical leave or even the ADA, which have job protective elements to them. So keep in mind that when you have somebody who goes out on temporary total disability under the workers' compensation laws, you should concurrently consider that a family and medical leave situation and make sure that you notify the employee that that employee is out on family and medical leave because it qualifies for medical, family and medical leave. But you need to notify the employee of that. But again, if you've got an employee out on workers' compensation for an extended period of time, you've notified the employee that you also consider that period of time to be family and medical leave, and 12 weeks go by, that is the end of your obligation to protect that employee's job unless under the ADA there needs to be a reasonable accommodation. But workers' compensation is not a job-protecting statute. And too many times I find that clients have employees out on workers' compensation for an extended period of time, and you ought to consider a policy which would be contained in your handbook, which indicates that after an extended period of time out on workers' comp, so for instance, 6 months, 8 months, 10 months, and certainly a year, that any job protected status will be terminated. And I think that there's a lot of confusion about that, so hopefully this will clear up that confusion. The last thing that I want to mention this morning is that the Department of Labor recently announced that it's going to engage in rulemaking regarding the standards for determining whether or not an individual is an independent contractor or an employee. As you know, this has vacillated between standards under the Obama administration, which were relatively tough to meet in determining whether somebody was an independent contractor as opposed to an employee. Then we had a loosening of that standard under the Trump administration. And now the Department of Labor has signaled very clearly that it intends to go back to a tougher standard which existed under the Obama administration in determining whether or not somebody would be legitimately defined or characterized as an independent contractor. I know I've talked about this frequently on telebriefs in the past. If you utilize independent contractors to any extent, it would behoove you to have a contract, a little agreement with that particular independent contractor, which contains certain necessary elements. We need not go into those right now, but the main elements of that is that the employer or the contractor, you, do not maintain control over the terms and conditions under which the independent contractor is going to be performing his or her engagement, that there's an opportunity for profit or loss contained in that contract for the contractor. You're not providing facilities or equipment to that contractor, and that it's really not of a permanent nature. So just a caveat, I'll keep you apprised of how this develops, but if you use independent contractors or purported independent contractors to any extent, know that the landscape will change, I am sure, in the next probably 4 to 6 months with the publishing by the Department of Labor of a new rule on independent contractors. Okay, those are the developments for the day. Aaron, if you could take this off of mute. All right. As always, any questions or comments I can briefly address, be happy to do that right now. Any questions or comments? Was there a question?
Howard, it's Ann. The only thing I would add, since you know my background is all with working with unions, is that we're also starting to see, this is on the wage and hour issues, we're starting to see unions also start challenging wage and hour status, making claims for back pay for overtime. So this is an issue that's really getting broad attention, and companies, as you've emphasized, have to pay a lot of attention to it.
Yeah, they do, Ann. And the problem with these cases is that they can be very expensive, both to defend, and under the Fair Labor Standards Act, if you're found liable in a willful case, you can be paying up to 3 times the amount of wages that are due. So, yeah, it can be a very costly thing, and unions are using it as a weapon, both in terms of attacking companies and organizing their employees.
Yes.
Any other questions or comments? If not, we will see each other in our August telebrief, and thanks everybody for tuning in. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.